Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Despite centuries of colonialism, indigenous people still occupy parts of their ancestral homelands and have done what they can to maintain their unique relationship with that land. In eastern North Carolina, the Lumbee tribe has had a harmonious relationship with that land for centuries, enduring radical transformations of the world that continue to this day. In the past, those transformations have come from incursions of colonial settlers and the formation of the United States. Well, now, along with the rest of us, they are challenged by climate change and other environmental impacts. Our guest today has a unique understanding of what that means because he is both a member of the Lumbee tribe and a scientist. Dr. Ryan Emanuel is associate professor at Duke University's Nicholas School of the Environment and author of a new book, his first, on the intersection of these native people and the world around them. On the Swamp, Fighting for Indigenous Environmental Justice takes readers on a journey through time while focusing on the Lumbee tribe's quest to preserve their natural environment. And we invited Ryan Emanuel to share part of that journey with us this hour. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Mike. I'm happy to be here.
You're welcome. You are a hydrologist. What's a hydrologist?
A hydrologist is a water scientist, simply put. So I study the status and the movement of water through the environment, so through soils, across the surface, and even through the atmosphere.
And what better way to study it than going to a swamp, which is essentially much of that area of the state. But you're also a member, as I said, of the Lumbee tribe. And for people who are new to this area, they may have never heard of the indigenous people known as the Lumbees. Tell us a bit about them and where they are located in North South Carolina and Virginia.
Yeah, so Lumbees are indigenous to what's now the coastal plain of the Carolinas and thereabouts. We presently consider our homelands to be centered around Robeson County, North Carolina, which is just on the western edge of the coastal plain, about 2 hours east of Charlotte. We are the survivors of first contact peoples in the 1500s and 1600s who came together to maintain their cultures, their families, their kinship networks. And our ancestors ended up in this area of the coastal plain that's now Robeson County, and we've been there for centuries. Yeah. It's part of our ancestral homelands, which have been greatly reduced due to colonialism.
We're going to talk about all of that as we go through this hour. But in addition to being an hydrologist and teaching courses in hydrology at Duke, you also teach courses on environmental justice. How would you define environmental justice?
Yeah, so environmental justice, simply put, is the fair treatment and meaningful involvement of everyone in environmental decision-making processes. So that could be things like environmental permits, but it could also be things like public policies that impact the environment or climate or energy. And so environmental justice is this idea, but it's also an area of scholarly research. It's an area of public policy. And most important, it's an area of advocacy. It's a social movement that, interestingly, has its modern roots right here in North Carolina.
And I was told that if I asked you to define environmental justice, what is it? I would get a different answer if I asked you, what is it to you?
Oh, wow. What a great question. To me, I view environmental justice through the lens of the experiences of Lumbee people and our neighbors on the coastal plain. So for me, environmental justice is very much a place-based concept. And it means ensuring that my community, as well as other communities, are able to maintain their cultural ties to the places that help to define their collective identities as people. And so for us, that happens to be our beautiful swamplands down in eastern North Carolina.
We're going to get out of the dictionary in a second, but the EPA defines environmental justice as fair treatment and meaningful involvement of all people in environmental decision making. And that has not been a common practice through history, as you spent a lot of time in the book writing about. And you write about how indigenous people who possess a lot of historical information and who have these almost innate ties to the land and an innate understanding of how it works somehow. They are ignored and shouldn't be because they know things that scientists are just now learning. Would you say that indigenous people, among all the different groups of marginalized people, are less listened to than other groups, or is it about the same?
That's a really difficult question to answer, thinking about all marginalized groups as being largely excluded from these spaces. So it's really hard to think about who is the most excluded. I will say that oftentimes Indigenous people's collective voices are not heard, meaning that they're not respected as more than a group of individuals. They're not respected as a community that collectively belongs to a particular place. So I do see that distinction.
You've written a lot of scholarly articles because professors publish or perish, as they say. But this is your first book, On the Swamp, Fighting for Indigenous Environmental Justice. And I know that you wrote part of it while visiting with, I think, your grandmother, and you would read her chapters at night, and she would set you straight on some things. Because it's not just a science book, it is a kind of a history and science book and an environmental justice book, etc. Why did you choose to write this at this time?
I started writing this book almost a decade ago. And the story that you mentioned about my grandmother, this took place right after Hurricane Matthew in 2016. Robeson County and other parts of the coastal plain, if you remember, were completely inundated by floodwaters. I managed to make it down to my grandmother's house near Lumberton and get her out of there and bring her back to Raleigh to spend time with me until water, electricity, and other services had been restored down there. And so it was during this time that I started writing and sharing bits and pieces with my grandmother, getting feedback from her. It was really born out of a need to tell stories in a different way than I had been trained as a scientist. So as a hydrologist, I'm trained to write a very specific type of narrative, and it's
Right.
so that my colleagues can easily digest the narrative of my experiment or my modeling study or what have you. But to really tell the story of environmental justice through a Lumbee lens, that model and that narrative of writing doesn't really hold. And so the book was really the medium for me to unpack these stories and tell them in a way that really gives respect to how full and descriptive and beautiful these stories are.
And as I said, you spent your life professionally as a hydrologist and writing about it and doing research and conducting experiments. And at one point, I understand that you decided that your data-driven approach to hydrology was not serving your native tribe's interest, and you decided to change that approach. Did that happen as a result of the book, before the book, after the book? Is the book a result of that change of approach? A myriad of questions there, so have at it.
All of these things are interrelated, partly because they all started to emerge at the same time. So 10 years ago, I was working on questions that had to do with how does runoff form, move through forested landscapes? How do trees take that runoff and transform it into evaporation? These are really fundamental questions in the field of hydrology. It turns out that they're not the pressing questions in the community that I come from. Of course, there are indirect linkages down the road. But one thing that happened a decade ago was that North Carolina's Commission of Indian Affairs decided to form an environmental justice committee. And I'm not an elected leader, I'm not a commissioner, but this group tapped me to come on board and journey with them through the creation of this committee. And together we learned about environmental justice policies, we learned about research, and we learned about some of the particular issues that face Native communities here in North Carolina. And so, really, it was jumping in with both feet into the practice of thinking about and working on environmental justice in the day-to-day lives of North Carolinians and of tribal citizens that got me thinking in this mindset and really led to a bifurcation in my research. On one hand, I continued running a lab, leading a group of amazing students and postdocs who are doing all kinds of field work, computer modeling, remote sensing. But on the other hand, I began to move into this area of studying policies that have implications for the treatment and involvement of Indigenous peoples in policies and decisions.
It just so happens that the Lumbees occupy what South Carolinians call the Low Country. It's swampy land. It's wetlands, much of it. Or they live in the vicinity of those lands and have occupied those lands forever. And when you talk about the environment, it's not just climate change that is going to be impacting these folks. It is. They are environmental concerns that result from human activity and human decisions that sometimes they are left out of. So, where would you put climate change in the list of environmental challenges that these people face?
Yeah, well, to be clear, climate change, of course, is a result of many decades of
Right.
human decisions that we know. But I've heard it described succinctly as a threat multiplier. And so climate change can intensify other kinds of human actions and decisions that have implications for the environment. I'll give you one or two examples. We make decisions all the time about how to develop land. And in Eastern North Carolina, one of the development practices nowadays is to erect these extremely large livestock operations, primarily for poultry, and also meat processing plants to convert that poultry into marketable meat. These practices have waste disposal issues associated with them that can actually be intensified by climate change. When we spread or spray waste from these operations across the landscape, we assume that crops are going to take up all of the nutrients, bacteria in the soil are going to neutralize pathogens. And then we'll get relatively clean groundwater that diffuses away into the environment. That's not often the case, and climate change can accelerate that by doing things like intensifying storms and bringing these large, massive floods from hurricanes.
Dr. Ryan Emanuel is our guest today. He's written his first book. It's about his Native Indigenous people tribe, the Lumbees, who occupy much of eastern North Carolina, and some of the environmental challenges that they face, and the fact that they have been left out, as have many Indigenous peoples, left out of the conversations that lead to policies that help or hurt them. We'll continue that conversation right after this. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Ryan Emanuel is our guest. His book is called On the Swamp, Fighting for Indigenous Environmental Justice. We're going to learn some new terms, I think, for many people today. One of them is something we don't think a lot about. When we take our trash out to the bin, which I did last night, and it's sitting out there right now, it just goes away. And the thing is empty in 3 hours. And we don't think about where it goes and what it does, but there's a whole lot of things other than trash or recycling that leave our environments after we have used them and go someplace. And some of those places have been referred to as sacrificial zones. It's not just trash, it's chemicals, it's wastewater, runoff, etc., that can impact certain areas. When it comes to the wetlands of Robeson County, which has been occupied for centuries by the Lumbee Native Americans, they're being impacted by all of this stuff. And a lot of industry has been using these lowlands, these wetlands, as sacrificial zones, pushing aside the best interests of that part of the country and those who are living there by saddling them with waste product dumping and fossil fuel pipelines and other infrastructure and practices that we would not put through Myers Park. So which is the bigger threat here, the impact of climate change or the impact of decision-making by humans regarding this part of the world as, well, we'll just, that's where it goes. That's where we'll put our stuff.
Yeah, this is really interesting. You know, whether we have intentional policies of creating sacrifice zones or if they're created indirectly through policies that don't proactively protect communities, you know, we know that these sites exist throughout the United States and throughout the world. These are places that are still very important, very meaningful culturally, personally to individuals and to communities. And just because we've collectively decided that this is where we're going to dispose of waste, or this is an area that we perceive as not having a high real estate value or other type of value, doesn't mean that these aren't extremely important places to people and extremely important places ecologically. I'll add one other thing about the wetlands of Eastern North Carolina and the surrounding states. This whole region's identified as a global biodiversity hotspot. We have very diverse flora and fauna that occupy these wetland corridors that run along all the major rivers of the coastal plain and their tributary swamps. These are also places that sequester carbon, that keep carbon out of the atmosphere and help to actually mitigate climate change. These wetlands have wide floodplains that can lessen the intensity of flooding if they're left undeveloped and allowed to serve as temporary storage for water. So these are all incredibly important places, but over the course of many generations, we've made decisions that has led to these places and others like them being considered sacrifice zones or places where we can put stuff or infrastructure that we don't want in other places.
You write about an example of that, and that is the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. It was a proposed gas pipeline. And you acknowledge that it would have brought jobs, it would have brought many benefits, lower costs, new jobs, less pollution to people in North Carolina and along the route of that pipeline, which went through several different states. But it was mapped through lands that were occupied and used by these marginalized communities of people, including the Lumbees, who had been completely ignored when it came to whether it should go through the swamplands of Robeson County. Eventually, that project, as I understand it, was abandoned. What role did you play in that?
I'm not sure that I had much of a role to play at all directly. What I did was work to amplify the voices of communities that did not have a say in these spaces where regulatory decisions or other kinds of decisions were being made. And I did some number crunching to show that we have demonstrable racial inequities in the siting of this now canceled project. So, you know, I give credit to community members, grassroots organizations that were actually on the ground campaigning against this project. And I think because of my position and my experience as a researcher who happens to work on quantitative problems, I was able to come alongside and show that, yes, these inequities are real. Here are demographic data that actually show that in North Carolina, Native Americans were overrepresented along the pipeline route by something like a factor of 10. 1 in 4 Native Americans in the state lived along the corridor where the pipeline was being built. And so these are things that people knew intrinsically who are organizing against this project in the field. And I came along and ran the numbers and said, yeah, here's another way to show that what you're saying is exactly true.
As long as we depend on fossil fuels, and that will be a significant amount of time into the future, we're going to need gas and oil pipelines. And there's usually opposition to these pipelines wherever they are announced. And it appears to be a left-right political divide, with the left, people on the left saying, no, not in my backyard, and the people on the right saying, yes, we need this pipeline, and here it comes. But is it that? Is it a left and right divide, or is it more of a monetary divide? We got all the money, we're the big corporations, this is what we need to do, and we're going to do it. Is it more of that? And while you're answering that, tell me what's wrong with a gas pipeline. What does it do to the environment? How does it harm it?
Yeah, I think your latter characterization is probably the way that I see it. I think this is a matter of power and money. And so institutions, corporations who want to pursue a particular infrastructure project or agenda will use their influence, whether that's financial or political, to push for that infrastructure. And that may be related to the financial benefits that they and their shareholders will see, or it may be for other reasons. I acknowledge that one of the reasons for these companies looking to build the Atlantic Coast Pipeline in the first place is because at the time they were grappling with this terrible legacy of coal ash that was plaguing all of our rivers in the region where we have power plants and decades of ash disposal. And pivoting to natural gas would certainly eliminate the problem of accumulating more coal ash. But at the same time, moving from one fossil fuel to another creates another suite of problems. When we think about climate change, one of the key problems is that gas infrastructure is leaky. And natural gas is primarily made up of methane, which is an extremely potent greenhouse gas. So we know that very small leaks from pipeline infrastructure can have very large impacts on climate change because of the potency of methane as a greenhouse gas. When we build these pipelines, the corridors or the rights of way where these pipelines are built cut swaths through these biodiverse wetlands. You can't have a swamp forest growing on top of a pipeline. It will permanently be converted into basically a swath of grass. You're limited in terms of what grows or what can be done with that land, basically in perpetuity. And so I think that there's some serious environmental impacts that come with these types of projects. And people also have concerns about the likelihood of leaks and explosions from gas pipelines in particular. When we think about pipeline leaks, people's minds often go immediately to oil pipelines. And we've had some horrendous environmental disasters related to oil pipeline leaks. When gas pipelines leak, that methane, in addition to being a potent greenhouse gas, is highly flammable. And so there are very real risks of explosions when you have leaks and compromises in the integrity of this infrastructure.
As geographic areas, as you know, you're a hydrologist, swamps serve a purpose. But they've often gotten a bad name, and throughout history, people have tried to drain swamps. It wasn't just Donald Trump who's trying to drain the swamp. It's people have tried to literally drain these swamps for years. And the title of your book may be off-putting to some people. It's called On the Swamp. You didn't just choose that title out of thin air. It has a particular relevance to the Lumbee people. Talk about that.
Yeah, on the swamp is a saying that we have back home, and it just means in or around the community. Is so and so on the swamp today? Is a way of asking if somebody's around. And so that's a phrase that goes way back. And I thought it encapsulated both of these ideas really well. The idea of environmental justice through the lens of the Lumbee community, and also this idea of wetlands and swamps as really important places hydrologically and environmentally.
And at the very start of your book, you make a point of exploring the formation of the coastal plains of what is now North Carolina and how they were settled long ago by the first people of the land, among them the Lumbees. You also say, and this is really interesting, that if you plot the history of man in that part of the world on a one-year calendar, with January 1st being the arrival of the first people, it wouldn't be until December the 10th that white people, colonials, arrived in that part of the country. Obviously, you felt it necessary to make that point in the context of your quest for environmental justice. Why?
I needed to unpack these ideas about environmental justice and indigenous rights and the technical details of the case studies that I discuss in the book. But before I could do any of that, I had to give a background course on Native peoples of North Carolina, because I cannot assume that readers know about us, about our history, and about our persistence into the future. And if you ask Indigenous people about this, many of us have, we've got a little primer in our pockets that we're prepared to pull out and give at any time before we can move on and talk about some other issue, whether it's policy or whether it's current events, or we always have to give this explanation of who we are and why we're still here.
You point out that a lot of indigenous people, including the Lumbees, have lost their native language because for centuries now they have been surrounded by English speakers, and it evidently doesn't take long if you don't speak a language regularly for it to be to just evaporate into the ether, which has kind of happened. And but a lot of Lumbees do have a dialect of English, partly because they're sequestered out there in one part of the country. But it's one that you apparently, from this conversation I can hear, you don't share because you spent much of your childhood there, but also much of your childhood here in Mecklenburg County and growing up here in Charlotte. Why didn't it rub off? Because you did go to Robeson County a lot. You were around your fellow family members who lived there and other people who lived there. Why didn't it rub off on you?
I ask myself that question a lot. I think the main answer is that I'm a product of an urban school system, and I think we pick up a lot of our speech and mannerisms not only from our families but from schools as well. I come from a family that shares this Lumbee dialect, and for that reason and other reasons, it just didn't rub off on me. But I agree with you, it is a unique dialect of English. Lumbee English has been studied by linguists and by other researchers. There are a lot of peculiarities of it that just make it its own unique dialect.
But while the dialect didn't rub off on you, other aspects of Lumbee culture did. You understand why?
I think because I grew up in a Lumbee family, and even though we lived in Charlotte, 2 hours away, I was surrounded by family members who carried a lot of those ethical principles with them from Robeson County to Charlotte. Idea that we should value our kinship networks. We should remember all of our extended family. My father, in particular, does an amazing job of picking out exactly how people are related to one another. And this is really important for Lumbee people to, when we meet somebody, we want to establish a connection with them. And it could be a familial connection, or it could be some common experience or thing that we share together. And so I credit my cultural values with spending time in Lumbee community and growing up in a Lumbee family.
And you also, at least in the book, you also credit CMS and one particular teacher at CMS. CMS gets a bad reputation, but they have produced at least one Duke University scientist, you, who's made some significant inroads. You credit some of your success and some of your understanding of your own people to Mrs. Rosa Revels Winfrey. She was a teacher that CMS brought in. Talk about her and why they brought her in to teach about Indigenous peoples.
Yeah, so Ms. Rosa had a career as a classroom teacher. She was brought to Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools to lead a federally funded program simply called Indian Education. And this currently lives in Title VI of the Education Act, and it is meant to provide supplemental academic and cultural resources to tribally enrolled students who are attending public school systems. And so, in urban school systems in particular, Indigenous students can be isolated, the only ones in their class or the only ones in their entire schools. And so, Ms. Rosa was there to bring us all together and make sure that we didn't lose our cultures in that urban system.
And you say she gave you the tools to do what a lot of Native Americans have to do, and that is to walk in two worlds. We're going to come back and talk about colonialism, which many people think is long gone, but the vestiges are still here and the impacts are still being felt. We'll talk about that with Ryan Emanuel in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Dr. Ryan Emanuel, Associate Professor of Hydrology at the Nicholas School of the Environment at Duke University and the author of On the Swamp, Fighting for Indigenous Environmental Justice. He is a member of the Lumbee tribe of indigenous people who occupy much of eastern North Carolina, South Carolina, and parts of Virginia as well. And you say that your people have had to endure the ravages of colonialism and the pillaging of the land for its treasures, the changing of the land through draining swamps and through the deforestation of those swamps. You say that some Lumbees have benefited from what you call this extraction culture, where they take things from the land. As they acquired newly drained land and made and converted it into farmland. So there have been some benefits for the Lumbees, but you suggest that a better way to understand how your people benefited from this is to acknowledge, this is a quote, that we were dealt a sorry hand and still managed to beat the odds. Talk about that. What kinds of changes have been imposed on the land over time, and why do you view it that way, as a means of beating the odds?
Yeah, you do a good job of encapsulating this really broad arc of colonialism that involves not just displacing people, but also transforming the landscape. And one of the main transformations that we've seen across the coastal plain is the ditching and draining of wetlands. And this was done for a variety of reasons primarily around the turn of the 20th century. It was done to reduce the prevalence of malaria. It was also done to increase the amount of farmable land. When you drain swampland, you can often create at least marginally productive agricultural lands. And so all of these changes have been wrought over the past few centuries. And in many cases, Lumbee people and their indigenous neighbors on the coastal plain, the Koharri, the Waccamaw, Suwan, have ended up in these marginal lands. And I'm really proud that we've managed to make the best of that situation. These were not areas that were prime farmland because those had been taken over decades or centuries prior. People recognized that parts of the coastal plain, the sandy uplands, were really valuable croplands and really valuable pasture lands. And those claims had been staked by settlers long ago. Nevertheless, we managed to not just eke out a living in these marginal areas, but in many cases thrive. And I think that that is something to celebrate. And so I was always looking for bright spots throughout this book, and that was one of them.
And yet, we think of colonialism, the colonial period, as being centuries ago, a long time ago. From what I gather, you believe that it's still the vestiges of it are still in operation. You're still having to deal with the ideas and the activities that result from this colonial activity. Explain that. How is it still a factor?
Colonialism's it's an ongoing process, and one of the facets of it is the extraction of resources from lands, and the movement of those resources from one place to another, and typically into the hands of wealthy, powerful, elite corporations. And so colonialism has changed facially, but underneath, this is still the same process of extraction of wealth and dumping of refuse. And so these are really important characteristics of colonialism that survive into the present. They show up not just in North Carolina, but all over the world. When we think about the extraction of resources from overseas, today, we're talking about things like the extraction of lithium and critical minerals for the production of all of the things that we say we need for this green transformation of our energy systems. Yet many of these resources are being taken from indigenous lands, and that is still a reflection of colonialism in the here and now.
The changes that you talk about, the draining of the swamplands to create farmlands, the deforestation to create farmland, some of those were actively things that happened, as you said, in the early 20th century. But some of these things are also happening because climate change is happening and drying things out naturally, or the sea water is coming m more into the land because of rising sea levels, etc. And just the way the weather is these days with these intense storms are causing problems. And it's created what you refer to as a narrow zone of habitability in an area that is shrinking, and that climate change is causing rivers and swamps to expand and contract unpredictably. We mostly think of it, if we think of it at all, we're thinking of it as being inundated by water. That's not the case.
Yeah, so one of the main ways that climate change shows up here in the Southeast is that our weather's becoming more extreme. So yes, we're absolutely seeing these extreme floods that are driven by tropical storms and hurricanes, but we're also seeing intense drought. And in many cases, those extremes are coming in relatively quick succession. It makes it really hard to plan and manage landscapes, water, natural resources when you're thinking simultaneously about the possibility of flood and a possibility of drought. And so this is one of the major climate-related challenges in the Southeast, is this widening envelope of extremes in our water resources. One of the things that this does is, as we see more extreme floods, we're really pinching people out of that narrow zone where it's actually pretty safe to live in the coastal plain. So we're really pushing people out of places where they have lived safely for a long time, but that's no longer the case.
I suppose it could be argued that that's an example of colonialism at work. The other aspect of your book deals with environmental justice, which we're talking about here, and you say that you make a big point of saying that native peoples have largely been ignored. As colonialism and modern day business and government expansion have taken hold, and you write about how indigenous people have now begun to take matters into their own hands. Had this been done sooner, had governments listened to native peoples because they do know things about the land that we don't know, had business development been curtailed as a result, would we be facing the climate crisis that isn't just being felt down there, but everywhere?
Yeah, I think to the extent that the indigenous values encourage us to think about the impacts of our actions today on generations in the future, that value perhaps could have led to policies that avoided the impacts of climate change that we see today. It's really hard to speculate and say what if, but we definitely know that indigenous communities often have these values around thinking about the influence of our actions on the future. And that's a different way of thinking than the ideas that got us into the mess that we're in today with respect to climate change.
Well, you do say that if governments and corporations had listened to indigenous peoples, quote, we would see a radical shift in environmental governance that prioritizes sustainability over exploitation and profit. If that had happened, would we still be living in a modern society? Could a modern society thrive?
I think we're seeing examples of this in places where indigenous communities are part of the conversation. In places like Vancouver, British Columbia, you're seeing First Nations people create development that is sustainable, that meets housing needs, and that has all of the things that we expect and want in modern development, but it's done in such a way that we're avoiding some of the worst impacts associated with pollution, greenhouse gas emissions, and things like this.
And people who may not be on your side, or people who have not thought about this very much, or just hear it peripherally, may think that, oh, well, you're just making a mountain out of a molehill here. But the way you frame it, you're not really asking for very much. You're asking for indigenous voices to be, quote, afforded the same input as garden clubs and chambers of commerce and other special interest groups. You point out that those who have the least experience caring for our home have the loudest voices, and they make nearly all the important decisions. And you write about the deep insights that tribal nations can bring to environmental decision making. Give me some examples of that. Where have we gone wrong?
Yeah, thanks for that. So I guess when I think about the involvement of Indigenous peoples first, I would say that in many cases we're not afforded the same input as all of those groups that I mentioned in the book. In many cases, we don't even have the same level of input as a garden club or a chamber of commerce, which is really frightening to me, that people who have lived for 11 out of the 12 metaphorical months of the year don't really get to have a role in decisions about the environment, about the places that they know best. I think some of the things we might see if indigenous peoples were afforded more say in policies. We might not see this massive expansion of the industrial livestock facilities that's currently happening across eastern North Carolina, because we may value that land for other purposes besides using it to construct acres and acres of livestock sheds, waste disposal areas, and things like that.
Waste disposal, and we've talked a lot about that on this program over the mostly hog waste, but there's also poultry waste, and you have an experience with that that you write about. After Hurricane Florence, as a hydrologist, you were collecting what you describe as reeking floodwater samples that were contaminated with poultry waste, and were threatened, and you were threatened in the process of collecting those samples by a farmer, a white farmer. He believed that the result of your sampling of these wastewaters would threaten his livelihood, his way of life. Is it possible to bring these two pieces of these two peoples together? In other words, his waste is threatening your way of life. Your reporting it might threaten his way of life. Can we meet in the middle?
Mike, this was one of the most puzzling and frustrating experiences that I write about in the book, because one of the things that I try to do, and I'm excited when happens, is that we do meet somewhere at the end of a conversation. We may not agree, but at least we identify some values or other things that we share in common. And I walked away from that experience feeling really down, because I didn't feel like we had connected in any meaningful way whatsoever. And I learned that it's not just that one instance where I was meeting this particular farmer, but there's a great divide in eastern North Carolina around this issue of water sampling and livestock waste. And it's really unfortunate, because I think we can all agree that we all want a clean environment for ourselves, for our families, for future generations. Perhaps we disagree on how to get there, but in my view, collecting water samples, monitoring the health of our swamps, rivers, and wetlands is essential to making sure that we can secure that clean environment for future generations.
I have 2 minutes left, and I want to touch on this before we go, because a lot of people who may be newcomers to the area have never heard of the Lumbee Indians. They're not as famous, perhaps, as the Apaches or the Cherokees or the Comanches, et cetera, and in fact, you are a very, very large group of people, which is partially why you haven't been recognized officially by the United States government. You are the only tribe that exists in a state of legal limbo out there. So, does that play into people not listening to you?
Yes. So we were partially recognized in 1956 by a federal law. That same law prohibited our tribe from having a government-to-government relationship with the United States. In doing that, it removed Lumbees from the laws and statutes that require government agencies to consult with tribes prior to making decisions that affect them. And so we're excluded from all of those protections because of our recognition status.
I could be wrong, but I believe that Donald Trump, in his one of his presidential campaigns, promised that recognition. Was it the first one or the second one?
He did. He did it during his 2020 campaign, and again during the 2024 campaign.
And nothing.
Presidential administrations are not the limiting factor in amending the 1956 Lumbee Act. This has been a congressional issue and not a presidential issue.
So Native peoples have been fighting to preserve their culture and their lands since white settlers arrived. Do you feel you're making any progress? Are you optimistic about being able to at least sustain yourself? And I have 10 seconds.
I'm absolutely optimistic because of the young people and the energy that they're bringing. So I'm really hopeful.
This is not a scientific book, although you'll learn a lot of science. It's not a history book, though you'll learn a lot of history. It's a deeply, intensely packed book called On the Swamp, Fighting for Indigenous Environmental Justice by our guest today, Ryan Emanuel from Duke University. Thanks for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.